Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode number 308, recorded July 31st, 2017. Nick Bilton. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Are you looking to hire a tech professional? With ZipRecruiter, you can post to 100-plus job boards, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/twit. Welcome to Triangulation. This is the show where we talk to some of the most interesting people working and writing in technology today. I am Megan Maroney, and today I am really excited to talk to the author of one of my summer beach reads. I knew the end of the story, but it still kept me turning the pages. I'm very excited to speak to Nick Bilton, who's the author of American Kingpin. He is a writer at The Hive, at Vanity Fair, formerly from The New York Times, and a previous guest on TWiT many times. Thank you. It's so nice to meet you, Nick Bilton. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
You have one of those names where I'm tempted to say it all in one. Nick Bilton. Do you experience that a lot?
People do that on Twitter. No, I always have to spell my last name. No one gets it. I have to say Hilton. It's like Hilton, but with a B.
Ah.
Or, you know, B as in boy, I-L-T-O-N. So
let's talk about your book. It came out in May. I really enjoyed it. It was, of course, about Ross Ulbricht, and he was the founder of the Silk Road. And so many of us in technology, of course, followed this story with bated breath. If you haven't, there will be some spoilers here, but what's amazing about this book really isn't the fact that Ross Ulbricht got caught and will spend the rest of his life in jail, probably, but really just how he got caught, the efforts to which he went to not get caught, and what brought him to creating the Silk Road, this Amazon for drugs in the first place. This guy who started off as a Boy Scout, like literally helping old ladies walk across the street, how he ended up thinking that he was going to take people's lives, et cetera. So let's start with what inspired you to write about Ross?
Well, I was a reporter at the New York Times. I was a columnist. And so as a columnist, you kind of, if your beat is technology, it's not, you're not just writing about, you know, Uber or Apple or something. You're literally writing about all sorts of different technologies and how they're changing society and the world and so on. And sometimes it's companies and sometimes it's not. And the thing that I'd written about hackers and Lulzsec and all these different groups, and I'd written a little about the dark web, and I was always fascinated by how quickly these things were changing. And I lived in an area of San Francisco at the time called Glen Park. And Glen Park is this kind of sleepy, not so much anymore, but at the time was this very sleepy little area of the city. And I used to go to these coffee shops and walk past this library every day with my dog and walk through this park. And when Ross Ulbricht was arrested at a public library, actually in Glen Park, very near my house, it turned out he lived very close to me and was operating this website where he was making hundreds of millions of dollars, selling drugs and guns and ordering hits and murder for hire and so on. And he literally could have been sitting next to me in a coffee shop or the sushi restaurant that we both went to or something like that. And I found that so fascinating that we live in an era where, you know, Pablo Escobar could be shopping at the same grocery store of you, and you just have no idea.
So had you, you probably had heard about the Silk Road the same way most of us had from Adrian Chen's Gawker article. Was that, I think, 2010 when he wrote that?
No, 2011 that he wrote in, June of 2011.
But had you done any research? Like, was that your beat at all, following the Silk Road, or were people looking for Ross?
No, it wasn't really my beat. I'd done some research, you know. I think I'd written a column or so or two maybe on Bitcoin or digital currencies. I'd helped some reporters out that were working on dark web stories, you know, the co-workers. But I'd read about it. I read Adrian's story. I went to the dark web and snooped around for 5 minutes and thought, wow, that's pretty cool and crazy and insane that someone would have the guts to do that. But I didn't, I hadn't written any big exposés. I was looking into writing a big piece for the Sunday Business section when it all came crashing down. But it was just a, you know, everyone at the New York Times knew about it, but it was also kind of this thing that it was unclear how big it was. No one knew how big the Silk Road was and how long it would go on for.
So I want to talk a little bit about the research. I mean, your book is so detailed down to the words that people use. Ross is, you know, just like he would say fudge instead of the other F word that we're all familiar with. And so I know you never talked to him, like he wouldn't talk to you. Talk a little bit about how you did your research for this book.
Well, in my last book, Hatching Twitter, which was about the chaos that brought Twitter to where it is today and infighting and backstabbing. First, when I first started reporting that, none of the board members that I spoke to, none of them wanted to talk to me. None of the big players. And so what I did was I started going, and they eventually all spoke to me, but in the beginning they didn't. And the way I got there was I started looking at their Twitter feeds over the years and seeing what they had tweeted about at certain events and moments and things like that. And it shed a lot of light on who these people were. And so they spoke to me without actually speaking to me. And so the same thing happened with American Kingpin. You know, Ross Ulbricht had lived his life mostly online for several years, either as the Dread Pirate Roberts running the website or as Ross Ulbricht communicating with his friends and writing things about libertarian beliefs on social media. And so we originally, I have a researcher that I work with, and we went through and we took all of the stuff off social media that he had shared over the years, you know, thousands of posts and photos and videos and comments and things like that. And we put it into a database based on time. And then we started going through all the evidence that was put into evidence in New York at the trial. And then I started doing what I do as a reporter and getting things that other people had, including emails he'd sent to friends and girlfriends and family and photos and videos of him, and eventually chat logs from the conversations he had had with his employees. And all this stuff added up to, it was probably like 5-6 million words of stuff. And we put it all into this database, and then we could kind of cross correlate it. So for example, and it all added up, you know, just unbelievably perfectly. So for example, when the Dread Pirate Roberts, who ran the Silk Road, would say, oh, I'm going away for the weekend to his employees, I want you to manage the site, he would log off and you would see Ross Ulbricht, the real human being, go on Facebook and say, off to go camping this weekend. And then when he returned, you know, there'd be a photo that Ross or one of his friends would post on Facebook and of that camping trip and the timestamps and so on. And the Dread Pirate Roberts would log back on and talk about a great weekend he had with his friends and a girl he met. And this happened thousands and thousands of times in the chat logs and the social media accounts and so on. And then you couple that with the interviews that I did, which was probably, I don't know, a few hundred hours, maybe 1,000 hours of interviews with law enforcement, going to the places that these events happened, the library where he was arrested and so on. And you're able to paint this picture of this incredibly detailed story that's better than spending 1,000 hours with Ross asking him questions.
Yeah, I mean, because at this point, what would his answers be? Like, yeah, would he tell you more?
Yeah. He's not going to say, oh, actually, yeah, I did try to kill those people. No, he thinks that one day he's going to be pardoned or some sort of appeal process will go through. And I think that, I wouldn't speak to me. You know, I saw him at the trial. I covered his trial for the paper. I met his family and so on and so forth. It makes total sense that, you know, that one wouldn't speak to a reporter who was writing a book. But what I don't think Ross ever realized, either as a Dread Pirate Roberts or as himself, he never realized, A, he was going to get caught. He didn't think that was ever going to happen. But B, he had no comprehension of all these things that he was keeping on his computer, from his diary entries to his chat logs to the spreadsheets and things like that, that they would ever be put into evidence against him. And it all kind of backfired in a way that I don't think anyone who was involved in the site could have ever imagined.
So how does that work exactly? I understand we all have access to everyone's Twitter feed, but how did you get access to his chat logs? Are they part of the public record because of the trial?
Some of them are, but there are others that I got access to, but I can't tell you how I got access to those. Just being a reporter. But you know, some of them are, there was, the trial went on for, I believe, about a little over 3 weeks. They put, you know, everything from emails and chat logs and interviews and even people being, you know, cross-examined by the defense and the prosecution, and they put all that stuff in there. Told you can buy the transcripts from the trial, which I got. But then other stuff I got, you know, just by shoe leather reporting, by going around talking to people, by, you know, meeting people and asking them questions and asking them for information they had and files they had and so on. And that was what led me to some of the things that other people didn't get access to.
And so I know that you like looked at the EXIF data and photos to figure out who took them and where and when. And I mean, what would you say gave you more material for the book, that shoe leather reporting that you're talking about, or just your spreadsheet that you made and comparing all of the things that are just publicly available?
No, I mean, I think the thing for me is I never, you know, my books are never, and even the long form stories are for Vanity Fair, I don't want you to think about the reporting. I mean, you do think about the reporting, we're talking about that. But when you're reading, I don't want you to think about, I don't want you to have to be broken out of the story. And with what all of this information gives me is the ability to write a book that reads like a novel in many respects. It's, you know, it's a dramatic tale, and you know, and it should read like a dramatic tale, almost like a murder mystery thriller. And so each little thing adds up to allow me to do that. It's almost like the, you know, Steve Jobs would always say that when you use the iPhone for the first time or something like that, he doesn't want you to think about how, when you pinch your fingers, it opens this, you know, the screen zooms in. He just wants you to be like, oh, that's cool. And for me, that's what the same thing with writing narrative nonfiction. But you know, there are times, I mean, every little detail adds up to something. For example, I got to go to the Chicago O'Hare Airport and actually see where all the drugs come in and where they're seized, and meet the dogs, Shadow and Rogue, and the customs agents, and so on and so forth. And that allowed me in the first chapter of the book, it's from the perspective of this little tiny pink pill, which opens the story. It's the first piece of drugs that are discovered on that are tied back to the Silk Road, and it's one pill that goes into the Chicago airport. And I went out to the mail facility, and I'm able to describe the route this pill goes through, but I don't tell you like, oh, I did this by going out to the mail facility or interviewing this person or that person, because that to me is not what the reader cares about. They care about the story.
Right. That's a good point. And I mean, you really do follow, just like you follow this pink pill, you follow Ross from his childhood. And, you know, there are scenes like where he's hanging out with a bunch of his old high school friends in Austin. And, you know, considering that he hasn't done anything in his life yet, where they're all working at banks, et cetera. And just all the steps that sort of bring him to deciding that, yes, it would be a great idea to open this this, you know, Silk Road, this database of where people can buy anything anonymously by using Tor. So let's talk about that a little bit. A lot of it is his libertarianism that brought him there. Can you tell a little bit about how that led to the Silk Road?
Yeah, he you know, it's interesting because he had a very altruistic goal when he started the website. In the same way a lot of the tech people in Silicon Valley do. You know, when Travis Kalanick started Uber, he wanted to make it easy for people to get a car. He didn't think that he was going to build a $68 billion business that would be on the front pages of all the newspapers and in all of the news, and him being ousted in a, you know, big coup because he was not a great CEO and so on and so forth. The goal was originally like, hey, getting a taxi sucks. Here's a better way. And I think that that's the case with a lot of startups in Silicon Valley. And it was the case with the Silk Road. You know, Ross Ulbricht, in college, as we all do, got involved in different groups. And the one group he really became enamored with was the libertarian group. And it was, you know, they would do debates with the Republicans and the class Democrats and so on and things like that. And he fell into it head first. And he believed, truly believed that, that making drugs legal would be a way for people, for society to become safer. And what his thought process was that, you know, people are arrested, millions of people are arrested in America over the years for buying drugs, selling drugs, so on and so forth. And that the government should really have no right to tell people what they can and cannot put in their body. And he at first, and this is the part that I completely 1000% agree with, the government should not be able to tell you you can and cannot smoke weed or you can and cannot take magic mushrooms. You know, there's been in 30 years, there have been 2 recorded cases of anyone dying from magic mushrooms. And it's not even believed that they're actually from the magic mushrooms. It was other ailments that predated them. And yet you get caught with magic mushrooms in Texas, a certain amount, you can go to jail for the rest of your life. And Ross thought that was ridiculous. And so the idea with starting the site was that it would make it safer for people to buy drugs. What happened though, as is what happens with all of these companies, is as the site grew and the stakes grew, Ross believed that he needed to up what the game was. And he started allowing people to sell any drugs imaginable, including heroin and fentanyl, which are drugs that have helped lead to the opium epidemic in America. And then he also started selling guns. And when things got really insane and the site was doing incredibly well, and there were potentials where the site could have been destroyed, he decided that he was going to put the hits out on people and have people killed.
Yeah. So, I mean, I have kids. I have almost 3 teenagers. And, you know, they're constantly making decisions that they cannot see the consequences. They cannot ever see the consequences of what's around the corner. And my hope for them is that they grow out of this, that there's at one point their, you know, brains are fully developed. But you make a good comparison of, you know, that he couldn't see what could happen, just like Kalanick couldn't see what might happen with Uber, or Mark Zuckerberg can't see like how, you know, Facebook would maybe have changed the outcome of this election. So, I mean, do you think that it's just as likely that Zuckerberg could have run the Silk Road and Ulrich could have run
question.
Facebook?
Without question. They're the same personalities. It's one of the things that was so fascinating is when I was going through Ross's Facebook feed, and he used to post quotes all the time, you know, inspirational quotes, if you will. And he posted the same quote from Ayn Rand that Travis had posted at one point in time on Twitter. Don't ask for permission or whatever it is. I forget the exact thing, but you know, they were the same people, and they subscribed to the same libertarian philosophies. Peter Thiel, who, you know, made billions off this philosophy, is the same exact way, you know, in quotes Ayn Rand and has the same philosophies. And I think that it's just part of the culture of Silicon Valley. There's an amazing side to it. You know, we have incredible products that have come out of that. But at the same time, there are always detrimental things that happen and negative things that happen. And either people fail to think about them before they happen. Like Ross, well, what happens if this thing gets too big? What happens if teenagers buy synthetic drugs made in China and overdose and die, which happened? How do I stop those things? There was no thought process that went into that. And it's the same thing with Travis, with Uber. It got so big that he started subverting regulation and, you know, doing illegal things and running the company like it was a, you know, an army on a battlefield. And I think that it's, you know, that they're all cut from the same cloth.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many moments in the book that make me think about that. There's the moment where it's like getting to the end of Ross almost getting caught, and he spends every day meditating, and it immediately made me think of Travis Kalanick. Like, I think a few days before they asked him to leave, like there was the big story about how he was found meditating in the lactation room at Uber.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just like, they're very, very similar people. But at some point, I mean, you see, like, I know you've interviewed Mark Zuckerberg, you've talked to him. So, you know, when, like, when Mark Zuckerberg was first accused of, you know, Facebook and was the fake news maybe changed this outcome of this election, he said, no, it didn't, you know, it, and business as usual. But then he changed. I mean, you saw him understand, and I guess the argument could be made that it was because, you know, of the bottom line of Facebook, and, you know, and it's obviously exponentially more successful than the Silk Road ever was. But do you think, I mean, at the point where, I mean, Ross Ulbricht never said, hey, like, it's, you know, no one's died from mushrooms or weed, but lots of people have died from heroin and guns. And so maybe we should do something to change this.
No, Ross is in the chat logs. And even as the Drepart Roberts and postings on the Silk Road, Ross said the complete opposite. He said, it's not my choice to tell someone they can and cannot put heroin in their body or that they shouldn't own a gun. It's up to them. And if they want to do that, then I'm happy to facilitate them getting access to it. And as far as he was concerned, by doing that, he was making the world a better place. And I think that the problem with all of this thinking is that there's no culpability, there's no responsibility by these people. You know, for example, with Mark Zuckerberg, he at first said he had that Facebook had nothing to do with all the fake news and blah, blah, blah. And eventually, I think there was just so much pushback that he had no choice. And then I think he actually realized, oh, actually, it did. And now he's trying to do something, but it's impossible to do something. It's, you know, it's a network of 2.4 billion people that share more information in a single day than, you know, than our brains can even comprehend. And so that, you know, and had they have thought about this earlier, it may have been a different outcome, but they didn't. And I think it's hard to put the genie back in the bottle. But as far as Ross was concerned, he just, his belief, there was a conversation he had a lieutenant, his name was Variety Jones, who was the kind of like his conciliar, and Variety Jones. And this is kind of one of the funny parts of the book where, you know, all these people are selling and buying all these things, but they all don't like each other. For example, the weed dealers don't want to be anywhere near the heroin guys because they think heroin's terrible. The heroin dealers don't want to be anywhere near the gun people. The gun people don't want to be anywhere near the hackers because they think that that's, like, you know, unsafe and blah, blah, blah. And these were kind of some of the problems that Ross Ulbricht had to deal with that Mark Zuckerberg doesn't, of course. But there's the one point where one of his employees, Variety Jones, finds out that Ross is trying to sell bulk sums of drugs, like, you know, kilos of cocaine and heroin and so on. And Variety Jones had been to prison before, and he talked about how much he hated heroin because he saw the effects of it on people and how addicted they were and how painful it could be. And there's this big debate that takes place between Variety Jones and Ross. And Ross says, you know, Ross clearly has never witnessed the things that Variety Jones have witnessed when it comes to heroin. But you know, Ross said, look, I'd never do it myself, but I would never, ever stop someone from doing it themselves. And if they want to, then that's their choice. And so he, I think, made a much more conscious effort to ignore the outcome and the side effects of these things, these decisions he was making, whereas I think other leaders kind of are oblivious to them at some point in time.
I mean, he was privileged. He did grow up in the suburbs in Austin. Yeah. And I mean, in some ways, his own privilege was one of the, you kind of make the argument, one of the ways that got him caught in the end. I mean, he made this, one of the statements he made that the DEA, I think, was able to have access to was he was arguing for this kind of marketplace so that if, you know, it's easier than buying drugs on the street with those other people.
Well, it was actually an IRS agent, Gary Alford, who is a fantastic character in the book, and he reads everything three times, and he's, you know, he believes everyone, no one wants to work with him, and he's kind of a sulky guy, and like but he's a great agent, and always looking for different angles of how to get into things. And he read these postings three times each of the Dread Pirate Roberts, and in one of the posts somewhere, I don't remember where it was, Ross had written, you know, his the reason he got into this, and he had said that it was that he referenced those people that you buy drugs from on the street, which Gary took as a racist thing, as he was talking about black people. And Gary's African American and grew up literally almost like he grew up in the projects, in the housing projects in New York, and knew the world that Ross was describing with fear and trepidation, which Gary clearly did not fear had grown up with. And he knew that, you know, there were all these little details that they were kind of putting together in law enforcement to figure out who this person was. And from that one little detail, Gary surmised that Ross was a white kid from the suburbs who had grown up in a pretty well-to-do family. And he was right. And Ross, I think, you know, I think that he, in the same, one of the things that I think is so fascinating about the story is that Ross was incapable of seeing how the site would affect other people. And I think that at the trial, he finally got a glimpse of that. And that was when the prosecution brought in the parents of some of the people who had overdosed and died, including this 16-year-old kid from Perth, Australia, who had taken this drug called N-bomb that somebody bought on the Silk Road, and he had an adverse reaction and jumped out of a window and killed himself. And that was the first time, you know, I saw real emotion from Ross, and he kind of teared up and apologized. And I think that in the same way you have people on Twitter who will write something nasty to someone they've never met and just go about their day without any remorse or guilt, but in a real world scenario, they would never say those things to that person. I think Ross felt that way about his website. He felt that he could only think about the positives, and he was incapable of seeing how it was affecting other human beings, and incapable of the fact that people were overdosing as a result of being able to access these drugs that they never, ever would have been able to access in any other scenario.
And do you see any positives in his story in the Silk Road? I mean, since 2011, marijuana is legal in a lot of places. Are there any positives that from this story?
Oh yeah, there's positives. I think that there are positives from the law enforcement side where, you know, it was such a mess and there was so many agencies competing, and it was a point in time when, you know, the DEA wasn't allowed to touch computer cases and the FBI wasn't allowed to touch drug cases and so on and so forth. And I think that the government has become more understanding of the fact that everything is now a computer case. They've put things together to allow people to, it's still a mess. It's still not, you know, the most perfect cohesive thing, but they have these task forces that work together now in different ways as a result of the things they learned from the Silk Road. But from Ross's side, you know, there was a study that was done, I think it was in 2015, it came out, and it was a university that interviewed 100,000 people who use drugs and asked them how they get their drugs and so on and so forth. And the people who buy drugs online, 20% of whom said they do so because they feel safer and they don't worry about, you know, being robbed or something going wrong or ending up in jail because they want to buy weed or magic mushrooms or something like that. And I think that Ross kind of proved his point in that respect, you know, is that it is a safer alternative to the streets. But at the same time, he disproved it by the fact that, you know, as Jeff Sessions has said, as the New York Times has reported and Front Page Stories and countless other people have noted, the Silk Road, without question, helped lead to the opioid epidemic by connecting people in the Midwest to inexpensive synthetic-made heroin called fentanyl in China, and tens of thousands of people have overdosed, and many, many thousands have died as a result of that.
Yeah, so there are consequences.
I think that's the most important part of the story that, you know, and this is not giving away anything for people who haven't read the book. As we see Ross's creation growing and growing and growing and it getting out of control and him putting it back in control and getting out of control and putting it back in control, we as the reader, I believe, sees how all these ancillary things that are happening, but Ross doesn't until the end. And I think that it's, to me, that's a really probably the most important part of the story.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about Julia, his girlfriend, and her role in all this, and also the agents that you talk to. But first, I want to take a second to thank the sponsor of this episode. And the sponsor is ZipRecruiter. If you are in charge of finding someone to fill a position in your company, whether it be a Silk Road type of enterprise or something a little more legal, you know it is really hard to find someone who you can trust. Ross learned that, and you probably know it too. So ZipRecruiter will let you search thousands of websites to find the right person for you. With just one click, you can post your job to 100 plus job sites. Their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. You know the people that you hire can make or break your business, and you don't know where to look, and you're stressed. Be stressed no more. No more juggling emails or calls to your office. You can screen, rate, and manage your candidates all in one place, right there on your handy device, your iPad, your iPhone, your Android phone. ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard is available on all of those places and connect with a wide variety of professionals, including IT experts, and then you can take your company to the next level today. More than 200 million applications have been delivered, and if you're currently searching for a job, ZipRecruiter will help you find your future career in any industry, including technology, government, business, finance, and more. Upload your resume and apply with one click. Be sure to check out the ZipRecruiter blog for recruiting tips and some really useful career advice. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, you can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/twit. That's ZipRecruiter.com/twit. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Triangulation. Okay, Julia V or Vi, I'm not sure how I pronounce her name, but she was his, is it V or Vi?
V?
V.
Julia V, Julia Vi, Julia Vi, V-I-E, I don't know.
So that was his girlfriend. She was the voice of reason, as most women are. But talk a little bit about her and her involvement in this story.
So when Ross started the site, he had he'd gone through a series of failures. He had gone to school to be a PhD, and he failed his PhD candidacy exam, and so got a master's, but wasn't able to go on to do more research. But he also fell out of love with physics, which was what he was studying, because he had fallen in love with libertarian thinking. And he had done, you know, when he got out of school, he couldn't really get a job, and he went moved back to Austin, Texas. He was like editing science papers on Craigslist and like doing odd jobs here and there. He was pretty miserable. He tried to build a video game. It didn't work out. He tried this. It didn't work out. And so one of his ideas was the Silk Road. And it was going to be this. It was essentially an experiment as far as he was concerned. He didn't actually believe that a lot of people would use it, if anyone. But the one person he confided in was his girlfriend, Julia. And Julia had been there the whole time through college and seen him, you know, with these experiments, building these video games and coming up with these ideas that all had failed one after another. And she just figured, it's just another Ross idea, you know, probably won't work out. So Ross had gotten a job. He'd taken over his friend's company. It was called Good Wagon Books. And ironically, what they did was they went and got books from people in Austin, old books that people were throwing away. And then they sold them on Amazon at a discount. And the ones they didn't sell, they would donate to local prisons. And so Ross, while doing the book company, goes off to do the website, and he tells Julia, and she's like, okay, cool, he's working on this weird website, and he starts growing his own magic mushrooms. He needs product to sell on the site and so on, and eventually he starts the site, but no one really uses it at first, and then one or two people use it, and so on. And to her, it was just this thing. It was like a, you know, imagine someone building a site like this and a couple of people use it. You wouldn't think that much of it. Sure, it's probably you should be careful because it's illegal, but you're not really like worried. And but then one day Ross comes home and he's really excited that someone is selling heroin on the site. And he's excited not because he likes heroin, but he's excited that people are trusting the site to actually sell drugs. And Julia's like, I'm not really sure people should be buying and selling heroin on the site. What happens if someone overdoses? And Ross always had a response for Julia. He always had a kind of a retort of how he could have a solution. And he said, well, there's a rating system on the site. So if you sell bad heroin, and you get a bad rating and people won't buy from you anymore. And she said, well, what if you die from the heroin? How are you supposed to rate? And every time they would get into these arguments, if Ross was losing, Ross would just be like, let's agree to disagree. And you have your viewpoint, I have mine. But when things really started, you know, as the site started to grow, on June 1st of 2011, Ross woke up one morning with Julia and Adrian Chen had written an article on Gawker. And that article about the Silk Road just exploded. It got picked up everywhere. It was on NPR and the nightly news, and Chuck Schumer, the senator from New York, said he was going to get task forces to look into it, and the DEA was going to take it down, and they were going to find the creator and put him in jail forever, and so on and so forth. And while it scared Ross, it also incentivized him. He realized the stakes, you know, he had more at stake, and he was excited by that in many respects. And for Julia, it was terrifying. And at the same time, people had started selling guns on the site. Julia was completely anti-gun. And so eventually all of this and Ross's refusal to give up the site, they ended up breaking up over it. And Julia, you know, went her way and Ross went his until they kind of come back together at the end of the story.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, you know, that their arguments ended with let's agree to disagree, because I find that arguing with libertarians always ends that way for me. I mean, it's totally right. It's true.
You're completely right.
And so much of the internet is based on this philosophy. Let's just start this new world. Everything will be fine. There'll be no sexism, no racism, you know, and it'll just be we control things. And often that we is like, who is that we? What do you say to someone who says that? Because I agree, like you said, like I agree the government shouldn't be able to tell us whether we can, you know, do a drug that hasn't proven to be harmful. And like, why is, you know, weed illegal still in some places and not liquor or cigarettes? But then there's always these consequences. So what do you say? I mean, what if you had talked to Ross about this and he had been open to you, what would you have said to him?
I think that, you know, it's interesting. So I was interviewed by some libertarian websites when the book came out, and I did a documentary kind of interviewing me, and I was arguing. I said, look, I completely agree with the philosophy that people should be allowed to it should be 18 or older or something like that. There should be some rules. I don't want a 3-year-old being able to go into a store and buy, you know, weed candy. But I said, you know, I think that mild drugs, they should be legal. They should not be illegal, and they should, and you should be able to buy them like you can buy liquor at a liquor store. And you don't go into a liquor store and buy a bottle of wine or a bottle of vodka that's been like mixed with rubbing alcohol or water. It's controlled, right? And the response, and I said, but when it comes to heroin, to me, that's not a drug. It's a poison. 33,000 people died in 2015 from heroin overdoses. That's more people than died from guns in America, which is also an astounding number. And those numbers are growing. It's continuing to grow. And I think that and the response from the people that were interviewing me was, people die from alcohol. People die from Big Macs. You know, people die from car accidents. Should we stop all those things? And it's like a kind of a ridiculous response, because there are rules and regulations in place, and yes, people break those rules and regulations, but it can't be all or nothing as far as I'm concerned. And I think that the libertarian philosophy is one that is all or nothing, and it is one that is unfair to the people who end up suffering from the all. And there are a lot of people that are affected by it. And I think that, you know, when I, as I was reading a lot of the stuff that Ross Ulbricht read and referenced people to read, there's like one argument about being able to harm someone if they steal your personal property or so on. And the philosophy essentially says, like, if someone affects you, you can harm them. But it's whatever, if that affects someone, like, if let's just say you came to my house and stole my car, and in the libertarian world, I was allowed to go and shoot you, right? And what the reality of that is like your family would be upset and people close to you would be devastated and your kids would grow up without a mother and so on. The libertarian philosophy doesn't allow you to think past that line. It's like, well, you came to my house, I shot you, that's all I need to think about. And I think that's a complete cop out and it's complete nonsense. And that was the way Ross ran the site. And as a result, he was oblivious to the fact that people were overdosing and dying.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the law enforcement involved. Carl Force, it's such an interesting character. You say most people go through life thinking tomorrow they're going to do something great. Like that was where you captured his interest in doing this, which was very similar to Ross's. Talk a little bit about Carl.
Well, I think just, you know, as far as that line about most people go through life thinking they're doing something great, tomorrow, and then another tomorrow comes, another tomorrow comes, and then there are no more tomorrows. And I think that the book, even though it's about the Silk Road and drugs and Ross and so on and so forth, it's really a book about ambition. And these are all ambitious people that are trying to make a name for themselves in some way or another. As far as Carl goes, Carl was a DEA agent who started off doing what are called jump outs when you're in the DEA and you pull up in a van with a few agents and you jump out of the van and you arrest a bunch of drug dealers on the corner. And it's a completely ineffective way of handling the drug war because someone else will just take over that corner. And that's how he started. And then he ended up, you know, down in the South in Mexico and other places and in you know, border states undercover as a DEA agent trying to do bigger busts. And what happened was Carl got a little bit too into the undercover stuff. He started getting drunk and high and all these other things with the people he was supposedly arresting and ended up as a result getting a DUI and getting, you know, going to rehab and getting a desk job in Baltimore. And he thought that was just the way he was going to live out his days as a desk guy in Baltimore. And when the Silk Road comes along, it looks like kind of a safe way to do a big drug case from behind your computer. How difficult can it be to not get involved in the being an undercover agent going too far? But of course, it's the same thing. And Carl becomes this guy Knob online. He starts talking to Ross Ulbricht about starting a huge drug website called Masters of Silk Road, where it would be kind of like a Costco for drugs, where you could buy kilos of coke and so on. And he ends up getting completely embedded in the world of the dark web. And he ends up turning and starts working for Ross and starts selling him information under different pseudonyms and starts stealing money, and so does another guy he becomes friends with who works for the Secret Service. And that's really where the story becomes completely insane. I mean, you could look at the Ross side and that's crazy, that the sweet kid becomes this Dread Pirate Roberts guy and running one of the biggest drug websites the internet had ever seen at the time. And then there's the law enforcement side where these people that are trying to hunt him down end up working for him and stealing money and do fake murders and all this stuff. And it's just totally chaotic and bizarre.
And it almost becomes so chaotic that that's how they get caught, right? It's just like there's so many different personalities. I don't want to give anything away.
No, I don't think any of this gives anything away. I think the story is so dramatic that even if you know, I mean, everyone I know who knows the story has read it in 2 days because it's just such a crazy story that they couldn't put down. And I think that the law enforcement side, you've got people from the FBI, the DEA, Department of Homeland Security, IRS, you know, local and state level, international. You've got this young guy, his name is Jared Yeagan, who's trying to hunt down the creator of the site. This is his first big case ever. No one takes him seriously. You've got these seasoned FBI agents who aren't allowed to do drug cases and have to figure out a way into the case. It's a little bit all over the place. But it's fascinating the way these personalities either come together or repel each other. And the race for them to solve it, and how eventually some of them become bad guys and others don't.
When you were talking about Carl, you said that, you know, there's always another corner, someone always opening up on the next corner.
Yeah.
Of course, like since the book came out, Jeff Sessions proudly announced that Pirate Bay has been taken down and Hansa shortly after that.
Alpha Bay.
Was Pirate Bay still out there, or was
Pirate Bay? Pirate Bay is the way you download movies. And
oh,
whatnot.
Right. Alpha Bay. Okay, thanks. I was just acting like I didn't know. I'm in the know.
You can't keep up with them. I don't remember half the names of any of these things.
I don't either. And when we were reporting that story, I was like, what? Like, I looked at some of the pictures, and I'm just like, why would anyone want to buy pink weed? Like, I don't understand. But
probably tastes better.
Yeah, maybe. So do you think that they've gotten better at taking down these sites? And do you think it matters? Because do you think there will just be someone on the next corner opening up on the next digital corner?
I think it matters because of the opioid epidemic. Mm-hmm. I do truly think that it matters because of that. I think it matters because when I was 8 years old or 13 years old, I didn't know how to buy drugs. You know, did you at 13? No. If I was walking down the street as a little kid and walked up to a drug dealer, they probably wouldn't sell it to me. You know, I would hope they wouldn't. And now on the internet, anyone can buy it. And there's a story from two kids that bought fentanyl, I think it was, a certain drug. I forget the name. It was a version of fentanyl. And these two kids, and they overdosed and died because they didn't know what it was that they had bought online and what they had taken. And I think that trying to take these sites down is incredibly important because of those reasons. What usually ends up happening is, there's a point in the book where the IRS agent, Gary Alford, who reads everything three times, he had read the original paper about Bitcoin from Satoshi Nakamura, the guy whoever that person is who invented Bitcoin. And there's a reference in the paper or to the paper or something where they talk about eventually the house wins in a gambling scenario. If you continue to play, eventually the house wins. And I think when it comes to the running these illegal websites and working for them, the longer you do it, the longer you're going to make a mistake, the bigger chances you are going to make the mistake, and eventually the house is going to win. And that happens over and over and over again. And I think that, you know, these people who run these websites are incredibly smart. They are capable of learning how to code on their own and grow mushrooms and do all these things, but they also make incredibly stupid mistakes. Ross Ulbricht had at first written something about the website on a forum and used his real email address. The same with the guy who ran Alpha Bay. When he got arrested, the Alpha Bay guy, he killed himself and hung himself in jail because he knew what was going to happen next. And I think that, it's always going to be hard for law enforcement people to figure this out and catch these people, but they're not going to stop. They're just going to keep going. And whoever takes over that next corner, they're going to continue to.
So in this scenario, the DEA or the FBI is the casino owner.
The government is the casino.
Okay.
The government is the casino owner. And they are... they're always going to win. They really are. I mean, you know, if the bigger you get, the bigger the stakes, the more the government wants to take you down. It goes back to, all the way to Al Capone. They eventually got him on an IRS thing. You know, it's like they on a money laundering scheme. And eventually you're going to make a mistake. You always do. You know, it's just you're you're driving around, speeding, running red lights, not stopping at stop signs, and so on. And eventually, as a result of that, you're going to get pulled over. And I think that, what I do wonder is, you know, when Ross was arrested, one of the things that I think for me was the most disappointing about the whole thing was he believed in this philosophy that drugs should be legal, that people are killed as a result of them being illegal, that people end up in jail, their lives are ruined, and so on and so forth. And he, when he was arrested, he never ever argued those points and explained why he had started the site. And I think he had an opportunity to, if he really truly believed in this cause, to be out there talking about this cause. And he chose instead to deny everything and you know, try to fight his way out of it, which is fine. But, you know, it just seems to me that if you know, when I look at the chat logs and the things he wrote about and the things he said and how he, you know, was so vociferous about his entire reason for being on this earth was to legalize drugs and show the importance of that. I just wish he kind of would have taken the time to argue that when he was given the spotlight that he was as Ross Ulbricht and the Dread Pirate Roberts.
And so we haven't even talked about Tor. The Tor browser, of course, is the way that you can access these sites. They're not available just on the internet. And you know, the Tor is used for many laudable reasons. But I heard you in an interview talking a little bit about how maybe Tor needs to be rethunk. Can you talk a little bit about that? Rethunk.
Well, it is the original reason Tor existed was because it was built by the U.S. Navy. And the idea was, okay, we are overseas. We have soldiers overseas and Marines and so on and so forth. And they need to be able to communicate with their family and even talk to, you know, supervisors or whatever. Sometimes over the normal internet, and we want them to be able to do so in a secure way. So if they're in North Korea and they want to email their mom and say, "Hey, I'm fine," or their wife or husband or whatever, they can log on to the internet. Not North Korea, but you know what I'm saying. they can download Tor and they can communicate in this completely encrypted way that no one can hack, even believably the NSA can't get into, supposedly. That was the goal, to make it completely 1,000% secure for the safety of Americans. And about a month ago, one of the folks who created Tor talked about publicly how disappointed they are with what Tor became because, and this is the quote, that 95% of all things taking place on Tor are illegal and nefarious. And I think that, you know, it goes back to this thing that I've said many times, that the people who create technologies don't seem to want to think about the negative ways they can be used. They only want to think about the positive ways they can be used. And I think that we've seen so many times over and over and over and over these bad things that have happened with every single solitary technology, every app, every startup, every product. And we will continue to see that with driverless cars and drones and this, that, and the other. And I think in artificial intelligence, and I think that the folks in tech have a responsibility to start thinking about the negatives in addition to the positives. And if they don't, we're just going to continue to find ourselves in these situations time and time and time again.
What about thinking about how do the positives outweigh the negatives? I mean, in driverless cars, you know, there was car accidents all the time.
Correct. So driverless cars, for example, 33,000 people die a year in the United States from car accidents. 95% of those are from human error of people on their phone, doing their makeup, eating a sandwich, whatever it is. Globally, 1.2 million people die a year in car accidents. In a world where there are no people driving and it's all driverless cars, the goal is that they will get to zero people to die a year in car accidents, because a million driverless cars, if one of them gets in an accident where they run a red light or don't stop at a stop sign or whatever, all of those cars will learn simultaneously because the information is shared between the network. So there's an incredible upside. But what if a group of Russian hackers decide, rather than going after the election, they're going to go and take the day the election happens, they're going to take all these driverless cars and crash them into each other and thousands of people die, or they make sure that no one can get to the election site except Republicans and not Democrats, or whatever it is. There are a million scenarios, and also the jobs that are going to be lost from driverless cars. You know, there are 10.5 million truckers on the road who are going to see their jobs vanish in the next 10 to 15 years. There, it's the industries that support the truckers, the rest stops across the you know, when you drive across the country, the driverless trucks don't stop to go to the bathroom or get a sandwich. The Burger Kings, the hotels, this, that, and the other. And I think that we're so busy rushing as fast as we can to the future with all of these things, so focused on the positives that we don't think about the negatives, and that is going to happen with every technology. And again, I just think that maybe, you know, we should be spending some time thinking about all these negatives for driverless cars and how to avoid some of these things from happening before we start putting them out on the road.
Well, yeah, we should slow down and think about the people involved. And I think that's what the book does, really, in terms of narrative nonfiction. It's a really good way to look at this technology that or this website and the people behind it, the people it harmed. And so I definitely recommend, even if you know the end of the story, I definitely recommend American Kingpin by Nick Bilton. You are currently a Vanity Fair writer. You write about once a week online and occasionally in the magazine?
I write a column every week online and then in the magazine. And then I have a podcast called Inside the Hive, which is a Vanity Fair podcast where we interview lots of fascinating people about a range of different topics.
So like triangulation?
Just like triangulation, yeah. But we get to, because it's Vanity Fair, we get, you know, I got to interview Conan and O'Brien, who was fascinating. We talked about celebrity culture. I got to talk to Joe Trippi last week, who was the famous politician who got a lot of people elected and almost got other people elected about the 2020 election. So, it's really fun.
So Inside the Hive, that's what you should search for.
Inside the Hive, yeah.
Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast you listen to if you like long-form interviews. And if you've gotten to this point, I'm guessing you do.
Yeah, if you, exactly.
Thank you so much. I love your pieces. There's no more time. I wanted to talk about the Fyre Festival. I wanted to talk about, we didn't even talk about your other book, Hatching Twitter. Still a really good read. It's a story behind the people, the untold story.
The drama and the infighting and the backstab. And it's a crazy, crazy, crazy story. Yeah,
definitely a good read, especially now, because I mean, that's, you would just don't even have any idea what's going to happen to Twitter next. Well, thank you so much, Nick Bilton.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Thanks for taking the time.
NickBilton.com. Thanks so much. Take care.
Thank you very much. Have a good one.
You too.
Bye.
And thank you for listening or watching. You can subscribe to Triangulation, twit.tv/try. We are on every Monday live. You can watch twit.tv/live Monday, 11 a.m. Pacific. Sometimes we pre-record the interview, so if you're constantly watching the live stream, you might be able to catch it there too. I am at Megan Maroney on Twitter. I host iOS Today with Leo Laporte on Tuesday mornings at 9, and I host Tech News Today every Monday at 4 p.m. Pacific. And check out all of our other podcasts at twit.tv and subscribe to Triangulation at twit.tv/try.